So, usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this distinct expectation of like total precision.
Right, it feels like engineering.
Exactly. You fall, you break your arm, the doctor puts you in an X-ray machine, and a few minutes later, there is this glowing screen with a jagged white line.
And the doctor just points to it and says, you know, there is the problem.
Yeah, it's either broken or not broken. The parameters are visible, they're categorized, and most importantly, they're universally understood.
Which is deeply comforting, honestly. I mean, we craze systems where the mechanics are laid bare, where cause and effect can be traced with a single finger.
But the moment you step out of the hospital and into the world of money, into the mechanics of the global economy, that X-ray machine just shatters.
Oh, completely. It goes dark.
We are suddenly navigating a financial landscape that is, well, completely murky. I mean, every single person listening to this deep dive uses money every single day. You tap a card, you transfer funds on your phone, you check your balance.
Right, it's just part of breathing.
But if you stop and ask someone, even someone highly educated, to actually define what that money is, or precisely where it comes from before it hits their account, things get incredibly blurry, incredibly
Which
fast.
is actually quite terrifying when you think about the stakes. I mean, we are operating a machine that dictates human survival. Yet most of us just assume money is this fixed, immutable law of nature, like gravity.
Yeah, like it just exists.
Exactly. We operate under this inherited assumption that money has to come from a central bank, that it must be printed by a sovereign government, and fundamentally that it has to be borrowed into existence.
And that blurriness, that unquestioned assumption, is exactly what we are dismantling today. Because in 1934, that exact lack of understanding, that total reliance on a centralized, fragile system, well, it caused the global economy to freeze
It
completely.
was absolute gridlock.
So today, we are going to explore the story of a group of Swiss rebels who looked at a catastrophic financial collapse and decided to build their own economic X-ray machine. They asked a question that really challenges the foundation of the global economy, like, what actually is money? And do you really need a bank to create it?
It's a massive question. And to unpack this, we're synthesizing some truly remarkable historical and economic analyses today.
We really have quite a stack of sources for this deep dive.
We do. A lot of our direction comes from a highly critical, deeply rigorous review written by Thomas H. Greco Jr. and Theo Maghalli. They spent a massive amount of time dissecting a book called WIR and the Swiss National Economy.
And that book was by Professor Tobias Studer,
Yeah,
right?
exactly. Professor Studer actually served on the advisory board of the organization we're going to discuss, so he has this insider view, and Greco provides the external critique.
But it isn't just modern critiques, which I love. We are pulling from ground-level observations, too. We have this incredibly detailed field report from a researcher named Eric S. Hensch.
Right, he traveled to Switzerland back in 1971 just to see this system with his own eyes.
And we have another field report from Susan Witt, who went back decades later in 2008 to see how the system had evolved. Plus, to anchor all of those ground-level observations in actual economic mechanics, we'll be heavily referencing E.C. Riegel's foundational work, Flight from Inflation.
Which is a mind-bending read on its own.
It really is. And finally, to understand what this alternative system was fighting against and eventually succumbed to, we are going to look at the conventional banking landscape. We're drawing context straight from the recent annual report of the Swiss Bankers Association.
So we have the theory, the critique, the historical evidence, and the modern establishment view.
Perfect. So if you run a small business today, say you own a local bakery or you work as an independent contractor, you know exactly how it feels when the credit markets tighten up.
Oh, you feel it immediately.
Yeah. You know what it feels like when the bank says no, even when you have the skills and the inventory to do the work? The story of the WIR Economic Circle Cooperative in Switzerland proves that the current way we think about money is just one option.
Just one way of doing things. And to grasp just how radical this alternative is, we have to look at the environment that forced it into
Right,
existence.
the catalyst.
Exactly. We have to look at a moment when the conventional system had failed so spectacularly that people were left with literally no other choice.
So, paint that picture for us. Where does the story of this we economy actually begin?
Okay, so we are in Switzerland, and the year is 1934. The Great Depression has its grip firmly around the throat of the global economy.
A really bleak time.
Extremely bleak. And the sheer scale of the paralysis is difficult to comprehend from a modern vantage point. Like, according to the historical data outlined in our sources, global total production had plummeted in the space of just a few years by an estimated 60%.
Wait, let me stop you there, because 60% isn't just a recession.
No, it's not.
That is an unimaginable halt to human productivity. That means more than half of the factories, the farms, the workshops, they simply stopped moving.
It was absolute economic gridlock.
Yeah.
And the collapse of the demand side, the fact that consumers suddenly had zero purchasing power, well, it led to drastic, ruinous price reductions.
Because nobody could buy anything.
Right. On average, world market prices crashed by 30%.
Mm-hmm.
The sources give this incredibly vivid, honestly heartbreaking historical example of how distorted things became. Agrarian countries were hit so hard and prices fell so low that Brazil found itself forced to use its unmarketable coffee beans as locomotive fuel in place of coal.
Wait, really? Shoveling coffee into a train engine?
Literally burning coffee to run trains.
Because nobody has the cash to buy it for a morning cup.
Well,
that perfectly encapsulates the absurdity of the crisis. I mean, you have the coffee, you have people who want the coffee, but the bridge between them is just gone.
That is the pivotal realization right there. The crucial thing to understand is why nobody had the money. It wasn't because the coffee disappeared.
Right.
It wasn't because the trains stopped needing fuel or because human desire just evaporated. It was because there was a massive artificial shortage of official money in circulation.
Artificial shortage. So someone was holding it back.
Exactly. The central banks, in their attempts to manage the gold standard and mitigate earlier excesses, had essentially frozen the money supply. They locked it up.
So if we look at a local town in Switzerland during this time, you have goods sitting on shelves, you have services, plumbers, carpenters, accountants who desperately want to work.
Yeah, they have the skills.
And you have people who desperately need to buy those things. But the mechanism to connect them has just vanished into the vaults of the central banks.
Small and medium-sized enterprises, we call them SMEs, were just starving for liquidity. A carpenter couldn't pay the lumber mill. The lumber mill couldn't pay its workers, and the workers couldn't buy bread from the baker.
Just a cascading failure.
And not because any of these businesses were inherently flawed or producing bad products, but solely because the medium of exchange had evaporated.
This is where Werner Zimmermann and Paul Enns enter the picture, right?
Yes. Zimmermann and Enns were observing this devastating, entirely artificial paralysis in Switzerland. And they realized something profound, something that most people during a crisis just fail to see.
Which was?
That waiting for political solutions or waiting for the central banks to suddenly realize their error and flush the economy with liquidity was a fool's errand.
Politicians to form a committee to design one.
Exactly. So in October 1934 in Zurich, they took matters into their own hands. They gathered a small group and founded the Wirtschaftsring Genossenschaft.
Which translates directly to the Economic Circle Cooperative.
Right. And the acronym of that organization, WIR, literally translates to the word we in German.
We, that is such a deliberate psychological framing. It isn't the state economy. It isn't the bank economy. It's the we economy. I love that.
It's a very powerful statement of intent.
So what were they actually doing? I mean, if they didn't have Swiss francs because the central banks had hoarded them all, how do you start an economy from scratch?
WIR was born as a solidarity-oriented self-help organization. At its absolute core, it was essentially a highly complex cashless barter system. But we have to be careful with the word barter, because it usually brings up the wrong imagery.
Yeah, usually when someone says barter, we picture it like medieval villages. I have three chickens, you have a dairy cow, and we stand in the mud trying to figure out the exchange rate.
Exactly, the classic textbook example.
Which is incredibly inefficient if I want milk, but you happen to be a vegetarian who doesn't want my chickens.
Right, that inefficiency is what economists call the double coincidence of wants. It's the primary reason humanity invented money in the first place, to serve as a universal intermediary so you don't have to find the vegetarian who wants chickens.
Okay, so how did WIR fix that without cash?
They bypassed this inefficiency without using state money. They did it through a centralized mutual credit ledger.
A ledger. Okay, let me try to build a mental model here to see if I'm tracking the mechanics.
Go for it.
Imagine a neighborhood that sets up a tool sharing and labor sharing group. But instead of just trading a lawnmower directly for a power drill, which requires that double coincidence of wants you mentioned, the group sets up a central ledger, like just a simple notebook.
Right, a central record.
So I mow your lawn, and the person holding the notebook credits my account with 50 points. I don't need anything from you in return right then. Tomorrow my sink breaks. I call a plumber who is also in the group. He fixes the sink. I transfer my 50 points to him via the notebook.
That's perfect.
We're trading real, tangible value, but the points are just keeping score of who has provided value to the community and who has consumed it.
That is a flawless analogy. You are trading plumbing services for groceries or architectural plans for winter coats, and the central office in Zurich is just the person holding the notebook, keeping the score.
But did it actually work? It sounds great in a neighborhood of 10 people, but can you really run a national economy that way?
Well, the historical data from the WIR Pioneer publication, which Greco cites in his review, is astounding. They started in 1934 with just 16 people and 42,000 Swiss francs of cooperative capital.
Pretty small beginnings.
Very small.
Yeah.
But the system grew rapidly because the need for liquidity was so desperate. Businesses were flocking to it just to survive.
It wasn't an academic exercise for them. It was literally a matter of keeping the lights on.
Exactly. But, you know, any startup, especially one trying to reinvent money from scratch, has to hit speed bumps.
Oh, for sure. What happened?
They hit a massive one. From 1939 to 1942, the entire cooperative went through a severe existential crisis. The sources suggest their early credit regulations were simply too lax. People were spending credits without providing enough goods back into the network, creating massive internal imbalances.
So the ledger was getting lopsided. People were consuming value, but not actually producing it.
Right. The cooperative was on the brink of collapse. They were saved only because a core group of loyal members who recognized how absolutely vital the system was reached into their own pockets.
Wow, they bailed themselves out.
Yeah, they injected about 250,000 francs of emergency capital to patch the hole and keep the administrative side afloat.
They believed in the lifeboat enough to bail the water out themselves. And that loyalty clearly paid off because the system didn't die in 1942.
Far from it. By 1970, the system boasted 18,000 active participants, and they were clearing 180 million Swiss francs, equivalent in pure ledger trade.
Wait, hold on. You said clearing trade.
Yeah.
If they didn't have cash and they weren't using the Swiss francs, what exactly was changing hands? I mean, did they print their own paper money? Did they have a printing press in a basement in Zurich churning out WIR dollar bills?
That is a crucial point of clarification, and it's something Greco emphasizes really heavily in his critique of Studer's book. WIR, in its mature and most effective form, is strictly a bookkeeping entity.
Meaning there's nothing physical to hold.
Meaning there is no physical paper currency to steal, to lose in a fire, or to forge. It exists entirely as ledger entries.
Just numbers in a book.
Exactly. As Studer himself notes in his analysis, WIR exists merely as a bookkeeping entity, and because of that specific architecture, WIR is essentially theft-proof. You can't rob a wire bank vault because there's nothing in it but data.
But did they ever try physical money? It seems like a really tough psychological leap for people in the 1930s to go from heavy gold-backed francs to invisible ledger points.
They did try it initially. In the very early days, they utilized paper certificates, and they implemented a fascinating, highly controversial economic concept to ensure those certificates kept moving.
Kept moving? Why wouldn't they move? I mean, if you're in a depression, aren't you trying to buy things?
Actually, the exact opposite happens. When money is scarce, the natural human psychological instinct is to hoard it.
Oh, right. Panic saving.
Exactly. You stuff it in your mattress because you don't know when you'll get more. But hoarding is exactly what causes economic paralysis. So the early WIR founders utilized a concept from a theorist named Silvio Gissell. It's a mechanism called demurrage.
Demurrage. I've seen that term in shipping, like a penalty fee for leaving your cargo at the dock too long. How does that apply to money?
It is exactly a penalty fee, but applied to currency. To keep your physical WIR paper certificate legally valid for trade, you are obligated to buy a physical stamp from the central office every single month and paste it on the back of the bill.
So the money itself has a maintenance cost.
Yes. Over the course of a year, the currency was subjected to a 12% negative interest rate.
That is wild. If I have 100 WIR in my wallet and I just sit on it out of fear, it effectively bleeds value.
It rusts.
After a year, I've lost 12% of my purchasing power just by holding it because I had to keep buying those monthly stamps to keep the bill legal. It literally turns money into a hot potato.
That was Gesell's exact intention. Money should rust. just like the real goods it represents. The idea was to forcefully accelerate the velocity of the currency. If you have it, you spend it immediately, which drives demand for local businesses.
So did it work?
Well, conceptually, yes, but in practice, it proved highly problematic for WIR.
Why? If it forces people to spend, doesn't that solve the depression problem?
Because those physical paper certificates started leaking outside the official membership circle.
Ah.
Non-members were getting hold of them, and the WIR central office couldn't control the circulation or enforce the stamp collection efficiently. Furthermore, as Greco points out in his critique, if you transition to a pure mutual credit ledger, where the credits are strictly accounting entries, demurrage becomes entirely unnecessary.
Right, because you can't hoard ledger entries in a mattress.
Exactly. Because of these immense administrative complications, the paper certificates and the demurrage feature were formally dropped in 1948.
Okay, so they retreated back to the purity of the ledger, the notebook. I understand the macro theory here, but I really want to ground this.
Sure.
I want to know what this looks like for a regular person waking up on a Tuesday trying to run a business. Let's dig into the mechanics of how the WIR engine actually operates on the ground.
We have the perfect lens for that.
Yeah.
Eric Hanch's 1971 field report gives us a concrete, step-by-step walkthrough of a transaction.
Awesome. Take me to Switzerland in 1971.
Okay, you are a WIR participant. You run a small business, and you decide you need to buy a new suit. The suit is priced at 400 Swiss francs.
Okay, I need a suit, but I want to preserve my hard cash for things I absolutely can't buy in the network, like paying my federal taxes.
Right, exactly. So you open up the official WIR classified directory, and this directory is massive. It lists thousands of articles and services, from chimney sweeps to corporate architects. You flip to the section for tailors, and you find a tailor who is also an active WIR participant.
Does the directory tell me how they split the payment? Like, do they take 100% IR?
Not usually. Most businesses used a hybrid model to ensure they still had some cash flow for external expenses. Let's say this specific tailor's listing states they accept 40% IR for their goods.
Okay, the math is straightforward. 40% the 400 franc suit is 160.
Perfect. When you go to pay, you don't hand them 160 francs. You write out what is called a WIR booking order for 160 WIR. Visually, this looks very similar to a standard bank check, but it carries a crucial legal difference.
What is?
It is strictly non-transferable.
So the tailor can't just take my booking order, endorse the back with his signature, and hand it to his butcher to pay for meat.
He cannot. The tailor must send that specific physical booking order directly to the WIR central office in Basel. Meanwhile, you pay the remaining 240 francs to the tailor in standard physical Swiss franc cash.
So it's a split transaction. I preserve 160 francs of my hard currency, and the tailor gets 240 in cash to pay his taxes, plus 160 in WIR credits that he can now use to buy lumber or hire an accountant within the network.
Exactly. And here's the genius of their revenue model. When the tailor sends that booking order to Basel, the central office credits his WIR account with the 160 points. But to cover the cost of running the office, paying the clerks, and managing the ledger, they charge the tailor a tiny administrative fee.
How much?
Just 1%. And that fee must be paid in hard Swiss franc cash.
1%. So for a 160 WIR transaction, the central office charges 1.660 Swiss francs. That is an incredibly lean, almost frictionless overhead.
It is.
They are facilitating this massive cashless trade network and taking just enough real-world cash to keep the lights on.
It's brilliant in its simplicity, really. It scales beautifully because the administration cost is fractional.
But, you know, 1971 was a long time ago. The global economy is entirely different now. Does a system like this still function in the modern era of digital finance and multinational supply chains?
It absolutely scaled into the modern era. For a contemporary perspective, we lean on Susan Witt's observations. She traveled to Switzerland in 2008 and visited a town called Rheinfelden, right on the German border.
What was happening in Rheinfelden?
She observed an old-fashioned European spa hotel, the kind built around natural hot mineral springs. The entrepreneurial couple who owned it were planning a massive, highly ambitious expansion. They were building a 22-unit upscale condominium project, which would connect to a newly renovated commercial kitchen and a modern restaurant.
Wow. Okay, that isn't buying a suit.
No, not at all.
That is heavy capital expenditure. We are talking millions in construction costs.
He needed to borrow 4 million francs to make it happen. And rather than going to a conventional mega bank, he utilized the WIR bank.
How does that even work at a multi-million scale? Does the WIR bank just type 4 million into his account?
It was a highly sophisticated, layered financing strategy. First, The WIR bank lent him 500,000 WIR credits at 0% interest, specifically to place those funds directly into circulation.
Let me pause you. 0% interest on 500,000. Try walking into a conventional commercial bank today and asking for $500,000 at 0%.
They would laugh you out of the lobby.
They absolutely would.
But the WIR network wants the economic activity. Then, because the hotel owner was heavily utilizing the WIR network, he was able to secure another 500,000 in actual Swiss francs at a deeply subsidized rate of just 1%. The remaining 3 million Swiss francs were secured at 3%.
Okay, so his overall blended cost of capital is incredibly low. He is leveraging his participation in the mutual credit network to drastically reduce the friction of borrowing.
Yes, but the financing cost is only half the story here. This is where the macroeconomic impact becomes obvious and where Susan Witt's report is so illuminating. Because this hotel owner had this massive sum of WIR credit sitting in his ledger, he had to spend them within the WIR network.
Right. He can't take those WIR credits and buy cheap imported steel from a multinational conglomerate in Germany because the German conglomerate doesn't have an account at the WIR central office.
Exactly. The structure of the money itself forced him to hire local. He had to hire Swiss architects, Swiss engineers, local plumbers, electricians, and carpenters who accepted WIR.
That's amazing.
According to Witt's documentation, $1.2 million of the total project cost was paid for entirely in WIR credits.
That is profound. By utilizing this alternative currency, the wealth was geographically trapped in the best way possible. It couldn't leak out of the community into the hands of foreign shareholders. It created guaranteed localized jobs.
It builds an invisible, highly resilient economic wall around the local community. And this brings us to Professor Studer's analysis of critical mass.
Critical mass. Because if I have 100 WIR credits, but my pipes burst and there are absolutely no plumbers in the directory, my credits are effectively worthless.
Yes. A mutual credit ring is a pure network effect. It becomes exponentially more valuable with every new participant. The more diverse the ecosystem, the more bakers, mechanics, lawyers, and suppliers join, the more useful the credit becomes.
Makes sense.
Studer notes that thousands of local barter clubs fail globally because they never cross that threshold of critical mass. You know, you can only trade so many haircuts for pottery. But WIR crossed the threshold.
What does critical mass actually look like in practice, though?
Well, Susan Witt describes attending a WIR trade show in Zurich in 2007. This wasn't a small gathering in a hotel ballroom. It occupied four entire floors of a massive stadium.
Four floors of commercial businesses, all trading without sovereign cash?
Yes. She interviewed tradesmen on the floor who explicitly told her they secured enough contracts at that single multi-day trade fair to keep their sales teams and work crews busy for the entire remainder of the year.
So we are looking at a completely parallel economic universe. It's a shadow economy, but an entirely legal, transparent one, operating right alongside the official Swiss franc, but playing by a totally different set of rules.
A shadow economy that empowers the exact small and medium-sized businesses that conventional centralized banks typically ignore, overcharge, or exploit.
I am fascinated by the ground level success, but the outline of Greco and Magali's critique suggests there is a much deeper theoretical battle happening here. This isn't just a clever accounting trick. It is a fundamental reimagining of what money actually is.
It is the deepest philosophical question in economics, honestly.
Yep, right.
And to truly grasp what WIR achieved and what Greco is arguing, we have to immerse ourselves in the foundational economic theory of E.C. Riegel. Specifically his seminal book, Flight from Inflation.
I read through the excerpts of Riegel and the sources, and I have to admit, it completely rewired my brain.
It tends to do that.
Riegel presents a concept about commercial banks that sounds almost conspiratorial until you follow the logic. He argues that commercial banks do not actually lend money. He says they simply authorize borrowers to issue it.
That specific phrase, authorizing the borrower to issue it, is the core intellectual pivot. If you can understand that, you understand the entire premise of the credit commons.
But wait, I can't let you just gloss over that because it violates everything we are taught.
Oh, absolutely.
If I look at my bank statement right now, there is a specific dollar amount. If I go to my bank to get a $300,000 mortgage to buy a house, the standard assumption is that the bank opens a metaphorical vault, takes out $300,000 of existing cash that other people have deposited over the years, and hands that pile of money to me. You are saying that is false.
That is the great enduring myth of fractional reserve, conventional banking. The bank is not lending you existing deposited money. As Riegel explicitly explains, the loan is simply entered as a credit to the borrower on the books of the bank. It is a paper transaction, no money having been lent, and no new money having come into existence.
I'm really struggling with this. If they aren't lending me money from a vault, what exactly are they doing when I sign that mortgage paperwork?
They are providing you with a legal authorization, backed by their institutional authority, to write a check up to that amount. The loan officer literally just types the numbers 300000 into a digital ledger.
Look, typing numbers.
Yeah. The actual newly created money only enters existence at the exact moment you take that check, hand it to the person selling the house, and they accept it as payment.
So the creation of the money isn't happening in the bank vault. The creation of the money is happening in the exchange between the buyer and the seller.
Precisely. As Regal puts it, money simply does not exist until it has been accepted in exchange. Therefore, money is not a commodity. It isn't the thing you can stockpile. It's essentially just an accounting system, a receipt for value that has been exchanged between two productive parties.
If the buyer and the seller are the ones actually creating the money through their mutual trust and exchange, then the bank is just acting as a highly paid, highly privileged gatekeeper.
That's a great way to put it.
They charge me interest for 30 years just for typing numbers into a ledger to grant me permission to trade with my neighbor.
That is exactly what they are doing. And what Zimmerman and Enns realized in 1934, what WIR fundamentally proved, was that businesses could look at that bank gatekeeper and say, we don't need you. If money's just a ledger of our mutual exchange, we can keep our own ledger.
They reclaimed the money power for the people actually producing the value.
Yes. And this connects perfectly to a critical conceptual framework that Thomas Greco brings up in his critique of Studer. Greco talks about the mechanism of how money enters circulation. He uses the terms pull versus push.
Explain the difference. How does a bank push money?
In the conventional centralized banking system, money is pushed into the economy by banks making loans at interest. Because the bank profits from the interest, their institutional incentive is to push as much debt into the system as possible, regardless of whether there is actual underlying productive value backing it up.
Which explains how we get housing bubbles, asset inflation, and credit crises. They push money into the system to chase yields, not to facilitate real trade.
Exactly. But Greco argues that in a healthy, sane economic system, money should be pulled into the economy. It should be pulled into existence strictly by the actual, immediate demand for real goods and services.
So, under a mutual credit system, my desire for a new suit and the tailor's physical ability to make that suit should be the only thing that pulls the credit into existence. The credit is born from the trade, not from a bank's desire to earn an interest yield.
Right. A mutual credit system relies on members who are actively willing and physically able to offer goods in demand like food, labor, or hotel rooms to back the credits they spend. You are issuing credit based entirely on your proven capacity to produce value in the near future.
The theory is beautiful, but I have a massive practical question.
Go for it.
If anyone in the WIR network can just write a booking order, if I can effectively issue money just by buying something, how does the central office prevent rampant inflation within its own ecosystem? What stops me, a guy who runs a tiny struggling bakery, from writing a 2 million WIR booking order to buy a commercial mansion? If I can just write the check, what prevents me from destroying the ledger?
That is the most critical operational vulnerability of any mutual credit system, and it's where the administrative rules of WIR are paramount. The analysis here, drawing heavily from the strategic implementation plan referenced in the sources, highlights the absolute necessity of strict credit limits.
How do they calculate a limit that prevents me from going crazy but still gives me liquidity?
A healthy mutual credit system limits the credit line, the amount you are allowed to drop into a negative balance, effectively buying before you sell to about 2 to 3 months of a business's average proven sales volume.
Let's do the math on that. If my bakery sells 10,000 francs worth of bread every single month, my absolute maximum WIR credit limit would be capped at around 20,000 to 30,000 WIR.
Yes. And the logic behind that specific time frame is rooted in the physical reality of commerce. The average retailer or production business turns over its inventory about 4 times a year. A 2 to 3 month credit limit ensures that the business has the actual physical capacity and the inventory to clear its debt quickly.
So I can spend 20,000 WIR today to upgrade my ovens, dropping my account to negative 20,000. But the network trusts me because they know, based on my history, that I will easily bake and sell 20,000 WIR worth of bread in the next 2 months to bring my ledger balance back to zero.
Exactly. It completely prevents the pooling of credits, where reckless participants spend wildly and then have no physical capacity to reciprocate value back to the community. It keeps the currency tightly tethered to actual circulating goods and services. It is the ultimate anti-inflationary mechanism.
It aligns the creation of money directly, one-to-one, with the creation of value. It's an incredibly elegant system. We have this life-saving ledger that grew out of the despair of the Great Depression, that thrived for decades, and proved that a parallel economy could operate without sovereign currency.
It was a triumph of grassroots economic engineering. But, you know, the story does not end there.
It never does. Based on the outline of Greco's critique, this is where the narrative takes a sharp, highly controversial turn.
We are entering the 1990s. The WIR cooperative had grown massive. But the management in Zurich looked at their operation and felt they were hitting the conceptual limits of their original mandate.
What limits? We just established they were clearing hundreds of millions of francs. The trade shows were packing stadiums. What was the problem?
The sources, specifically quoting Professor Studer's internal view, mentioned that the WIR management group began to feel a pressing need to, quote, rein in the turbulent growth of the WIR money supply in a targeted way, leading to the need for diversification.
Turbulent growth. If I'm running a business, turbulent growth usually means I'm making so much money I can't hire people fast enough. It sounds like a corporate euphemism. What were they actually afraid of?
Greco is highly suspicious of that phrasing. He openly questions whether this growth actually threatened WIR's survival in any mathematical sense, or if their massive, undeniable success was simply becoming an embarrassment and a competitive threat to the conventional Swiss banking establishment. WIR was getting too big, and perhaps too visible.
So the management decided the best way to survive in a world dominated by megabanks was to play nice with them.
Worse, they decided to become one of them. In 1995, they took their first major step away from pure mutual credit by introducing the Combi card, which was essentially a mechanism that moved them heavily toward standard cash sales and conventional payment processing.
Okay, that's a shift.
But the definitive philosophical pivot happened 2 years later. In 1997, they introduced interest-bearing cash accounts.
Let me make sure I'm hearing you correctly. Interest-bearing accounts. The entire founding principle of Zimmermann and Enns, the entire purpose of the 1934 lifeboat, was interest-free clearing.
I know. But with that move in 1997, WIR formally completed its transition. They obtained a full license and became the WIR Bank. They ceased being a mere cooperative ledger and became a conventional financial institution that also happened to run an internal currency.
Okay, this is the crux of the intellectual battle in our source material. Let's look at the arguments because they represent two fundamentally opposed views of what money should be. Let's start with Professor Studer. He was on the WIR advisory board. He wrote the definitive book on them. How on earth does he defend abandoning the core principle of interest-free credit?
Studer mounts a very vigorous, highly pragmatic defense. He argues that WIR's ultimate superpower, the one defining characteristic that separates it from all those small, failing neighborhood barter clubs around the world, is precisely the fact that the central office evolved to act as a bank.
What does that mean in terms of daily operations?
It means the central office doesn't just sit there passively keeping score in a notebook. They grant active loans to members as a principal party, and they charge interest on those loans.
Like a normal bank?
Right. Studer proudly calls this autonomous money creation. He claims this aggressive posture is what gives WIR its massive scale and allows it to access economic potential that is usually reserved for national central banks.
So Studer's argument is essentially, if you want to play in the big leagues, you have to use big leap tools. If you want to build multi-million franc hotels, you can't just rely on plumbers trading with bakers. You have to issue top-down loans and charge interest to drive the system forward.
Yes. Studer makes a psychological argument as well. He suggests that when a member takes out an interest-bearing loan in WIR, the pressure of that interest makes them highly motivated to make sales. They have to hustle to earn enough WIR back to pay off not just the principal, but the interest. He views the pressure of the loan business as the most powerful driving force behind the velocity of the barter business.
I hear his point. It's a pragmatic, perhaps slightly cynical view of human motivation. Whip the horse and it runs faster. But then we have Thomas Greco reading Studer's book.
And Greco's reaction is basically to rip the book in half.
Mm-hmm.
Greco offers a fierce, mathematically devastating critique. He argues that Studer has the entire mechanism completely backward.
Let's lay out Greco's counterargument. Why is Studer wrong?
Greco argues that by choosing to act like a conventional bank, by granting loans as a principal party and charging interest, rather than just acting as a neutral third-party record keeper, WIR, willingly ingested a poison pill. They adopted the exact same fatal structural flaws that plague national fiat currencies.
What is the poison pill?
The poison pill is interest. To understand why, we have to slow down and look at a concept called the usury conjecture.
The usury conjecture. That sounds ominous. Walk me through the math of it.
It is a mathematical reality that exposes the hidden flaw in all modern banking. If a banking system issues all the money into existence as debt and charges interest on that debt, there is a fundamental impossibility built into the very architecture of the system.
Let's do a thought experiment to make this concrete. Imagine a tiny island economy. There are three people on the island and a bank.
Perfect. So the island currently has zero money. The bank decides to jumpstart the economy. It loans $100 to person A, $100 to person B, and $100 to person C.
Okay, got it.
The bank just created $300 out of thin air and pushed it into the island economy. But the bank contract says that at the end of the year, each person must pay back the $100 principal plus 10% interest.
So each person owes the bank $110. The total debt owed to the bank is $330.
Exactly. But how much actual money exists on the entire island?
Only the $300 the bank initially created.
Precisely. Where does the extra $30 come from?
It doesn't exist. The bank created the principal, but they never created the money to pay the interest.
This is the terrifying realization of the usury conjecture. The interest was never created. So the only way for person A to find that extra $10 to pay their interest is to aggressively outcompete person B and C and capture their money.
Wow. Okay.
But if person A succeeds, person B and C will inevitably default because there simply isn't enough currency in the closed system to satisfy all the debt contracts.
So a system based on interest forces a state of perpetual scarcity. It's a vicious game of musical chairs, but the chairs are constantly shrinking.
And what is the only way to keep the music playing? How does the bank prevent mass defaults when there isn't enough money to pay the interest?
The bank has to issue new loans. They have to find person D, create another $100 loan, and pump that new money into the island so A, B, and C can harvest it to pay their old interest.
Yes. It creates a mathematical imperative for endless exponential debt growth. The system must continuously expand the debt supply or it collapses in a wave of defaults. This is exactly what we see in the macro global economy. The absolute necessity of endless growth just to service historical debt.
And Greco's heartbreak over WIR is that they had a system that avoided this trap entirely. Pure mutual credit clearing doesn't require interest. It just requires that tiny 1% cash administration fee to keep the clerks paid.
Right.
By adopting interest-bearing loans in 1997, WIR infected their pure balance system with the virus of the debt growth imperative.
That is the philosophical tragedy. But it wasn't just a theoretical debate in an economics journal. This pivot caused severe practical problems for the stability of WIR on the ground. The consequences of acting like a bank started to show up in the hard data.
What did the data reveal?
Greco and Magali, in their critique, dug deep into the official WIR balance sheet that was proudly published in Studer's own book. And they found something buried in the fine print, specifically in Endnote 2, that is absolutely shocking from a mutual credit perspective.
What was in the endnote?
They discovered that nearly 90% of WIR's total liabilities were tied up in long-term 20-year mortgages.
Wait, mortgages? They were backing a circulating commercial currency with 20-year real estate debt?
Yes. Remember the Rheinfelden Hotel expansion,
yeah.
The multi-million franc project? WIR was issuing millions of fresh WIR credits to fund massive long-term building projects.
I need to process why this is such a disaster, because on the surface, funding construction seems productive. Let me try an analogy.
Please do.
Imagine a grocery store issues a gift card. I buy a $100 gift card, and the store promises I can walk in today and get $100 worth of milk and bread. That works flawlessly because the milk and bread are physically sitting on the shelves right now.
Right. The claim on value, the gift card, is matched perfectly by immediately available physical value.
But issuing WIR credits based on a 20-year mortgage, well, that's like the grocery store issuing $1 million in gift cards today. But the store manager tells you the actual wheat for the bread won't be planted, harvested, baked, and stocked on the shelves for another 20 years. You are matching short-term, immediate spending power with incredibly long-term, illiquid debt.
That is a phenomenal analogy, and it perfectly illustrates the economic theory of Heinrich Rittershausen, which Greco cites in his critique. Rittershausen explains a fundamental law of currency. Long-term debts do not qualify as a good basis for issuing money.
Because the money is supposed to represent stuff that exists right now. It's supposed to be a receipt for value, not a speculative bet on a building that isn't finished.
Exactly. True. Honest money must be backed by goods and services that are currently in the market, or will be in the very near term, like the baker's two-month inventory turnover. If the WIR bank issues millions of new credits based on 20-year mortgages, they are flooding the immediate system with purchasing power.
But nothing to buy.
Right. The tradesmen who receive those credits can't go buy a piece of the hotel that won't be finished for a year, let alone generate returns for two decades.
You are creating money out of thin air, backed by a promise far in the future, but the people holding that money expect it to buy bread, plumbing services, and suits today.
The WIR bank flooded the mutual credit ledger with credits that could not be instantly matched by available goods and services. They violated their own critical rule of short-term clearing.
And what is the inevitable economic result when you have too much money chasing too few current goods?
Inflation.
Yeah.
Devaluation. Loss of trust. And we see the painful, real-world fallout of this structural error in Susan Witt's 2008 field report.
What did she observe on the ground? Did the participants realize the currency was compromised?
They absolutely did, and the market reacted ruthlessly. Witt attended local Rotary meetings in Switzerland and talked directly to local businessmen. She spoke to a major contractor who confirmed that if you are in the construction trades in Switzerland, you basically have to accept a WIR to get the big jobs. It's an industry standard.
Okay, so they're locked in.
But because the WIR bank had overissued millions of credits against long-term mortgages, there was a glut of WIR in the system. The WIR currency began to fundamentally lose its value relative to the hard Swiss franc.
People had too much of it sitting in their accounts and couldn't find enough immediate, fairly priced places to spend it efficiently.
Right. So what does a contractor do when he has a million WIR credits but needs Swiss francs to pay his federal taxes or buy imported copper piping from Germany? He turns to the shadows. He started trading unsigned WIR checks on the black market.
A black market for a digital accounting ledger? How does that even work?
Tradesmen who were flush with WIR would find brokers who had Swiss francs. They would sell their WIR checks under the table. And because the street knew the currency was slightly inflated and hard to offload, the tradesmen had to sell them at a massive discount.
How massive?
Witt reported that these underground trades were happening at discounts of up to 40% just so the businessmen could get rid of the WIR and get some hard cash, especially at the end of the year when they needed to clear their books.
A 40% discount. If I sell 100 WIR, I only get 60 Swiss francs back. That means the currency has fundamentally failed to hold its par value. The central office in Basel might claim that one WIR equals one franc, but the street knows it's a lie.
The street always knows. Even the official legitimate accounting firms were treating it as fundamentally devalued. Witt spoke to a corporate accountant who admitted that his firm automatically devalued any WIR holdings on a corporate balance sheet by 20% before submitting the paperwork.
Wait, really? Just a flat 20% haircut?
Yeah. If a business proudly showed 10,000 WIR in their account, the accountant quietly recorded it as only 8,000 francs of real usable value.
Wow. The market always finds the truth. And Greco's argument is that this devaluation, this black market, wasn't an accident or a stroke of bad luck. It was a structural, mathematical inevitability the moment they started acting like a conventional bank and issuing long-term loans.
Exactly. They abandoned the short-term pull of real trade for the long-term push of conventional banking debt. And when we zoom out to look at the broader context of the Swiss economy, the tragic irony of this pivot becomes crystal clear. We have to look at the Swiss Bankers Association annual report from 2023-2024.
The report detailing the exact conventional banking world that WIR decided they wanted to join. What does that report show?
The SBA report highlights the defining catastrophic event of their financial year, which was the spectacular sudden demise and collapse of Credit Suisse.
Credit Suisse, one of the oldest, biggest, most supposedly prestigious banks in the entire world, just evaporating in a matter of days, forcing a panic absorption by UBS just to prevent a global financial meltdown.
Yes. The SBA report talks about operating in a world that has become, quote, more fragile, more complex, and thus, above all, more unpredictable. Conventional banking, at its core, is about maintaining a highly complex, incredibly fragile, interconnected empire built on debt. When confidence slips, as it did with Credit Suisse, the entire house of cards can come crashing down overnight.
But the whole point of this story, the whole reason Zimmermann and Enns met in Zurich in 1934, was to build an alternative to that exact fragility.
That is the ultimate systemic tragedy of the WIR story.
Hmm.
WIR was designed from its inception to be the antidote to fragile debt-based banking. It was meant to be a hyper-resilient, debt-free, localized clearinghouse that served the community and kept trade flowing, regardless of whether the global financial markets were booming or burning coffee beans.
But by chasing bank status, by adopting the poison pill of interest, and by backing their circulating currency with 20-year real estate mortgages, they voluntarily adopted the very flaws they were created to escape.
They undermined the purity of the mutual credit ideal. Now, to be fair, they survived. WIR is still operating today as a multi-billion franc powerhouse. But Greco's profound critique is that they sacrificed their revolutionary potential. They had the blueprint to redefine global economics, but they chose to become just another bank, albeit one with a quirky internal currency.
This has been a massive paradigm-shifting journey. We started in the absolute despair and paralysis of the Great Depression, witnessing the birth of a radical, life-saving ledger system that proved regular businesses could simply bypass the frozen central banks.
It was a true, undeniable grassroots triumph of human ingenuity.
We followed it through decades of massive, stadium-filling success, proving that mutual credit isn't just a neighborhood hobby. It works on a massive national scale. But then we watched that beautiful system slowly become compromised. We watched it adopt the conventional banking practices of interest and long-term debt issuance, leading inevitably to black markets, devaluation, and a loss of its revolutionary soul.
It serves as a profound cautionary tale about the deep, almost gravitational seduction of conventional financial power.
And if you are listening to this right now, I want you to think about what this means for your daily life. Why does an obscure Swiss cooperative from 1934 matter to your modern wallet? It matters because WIR, even with its later flaws, fundamentally proved a hidden truth about our economy. It proved that businesses, freelancers, and communities do not actually need official sovereign bank money to survive and trade with one another.
The credit power, the actual ability to create money, belongs to the producers of value, not the banks who guard the ledger.
Exactly. You only need a reliable, trusted way to keep score of your mutual exchange. The failure of WIR to maintain the pure value of its currency wasn't a failure of mutual credit itself. It was a failure of the conventional banking wrapper they eventually chose to place around it.
Which leaves us with a lingering and, I think, deeply provocative question that builds on everything we've discussed today.
Let's hear it.
If the only real difference between a devastating economic depression where people are forced to burn coffee for fuel and a thriving local economy that is building hotels and hiring tradesmen is simply the presence of a localized accounting notebook that lets people trade their existing skills, well, what does that tell you about the nature of the money sitting in your bank account right now?
That's a heavy thought.
Is it truly a fixed measure of value? Is it an immutable law of nature? Or is it just a deeply entrenched monopoly that we've all simply forgotten how to bypass?
That is a question that changes how you look every transaction you make. The economic x-ray machine we've been handed is definitely broken, but the story of WIR proves that maybe, just maybe, we have the power to build a better one ourselves. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into Switzerland's we economy. Keep questioning the structures around you, and we'll see you next time.